Everybody, and welcome. It's just a little after 11, Wednesday, March 31st, 2021. Had a little bit of a hiccup getting going, but we are here with you now, and thank you for joining us for the 106th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room here on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. Okay, now a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. And as always, thank you very much for that. And if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic. And I'm excited because I actually recognized that without a hint. Please go on.
Yeah, it's a pretty recognizable tune. So I'm sure as the listeners know, that was an excerpt from Pinball Wizard from the rock opera Tommy by The Who. And the reason that that's relevant for this evening is we're going to be talking about conversion disorder, also known as functional neurologic symptom disorder in DSM-5. And Tommy is the result of that. So for those who don't know the plot, basically Mrs. Walker's husband's lost in the war, declared dead. she picks up with another lover, and Tommy's in the womb when his father goes off to war. He's born. His father doesn't know the son. And then several years later, Captain Walker shows back up and is pretty PO'd, and they have this big row, and he ends up killing the lover. And then they say to the kid, okay, you didn't see anything, you didn't hear anything, nothing happened, you're not going to tell anybody anything. And he basically has a traumatic shock and goes into conversion disorder and ends up being deaf, dumb, and blind.
I am fascinated because I don't think I've ever known exactly what Tommy's pathology was. I think it was just sort of, I just went with it and didn't even really think to wonder. So that's pretty cool. I'm digging that.
I just thought that was the perfect intro for this evening's topic. So definitely. I was just like, oh, this is going to be awesome. Plus, it's a song that everybody knows. That's not going to go, where do you get that crap from?
Oh, no, I love the deep cuts. But, you know, I always look forward to learning stuff because there's always a cool story behind it. But I'm very excited that I actually knew what it was.
There you go.
And that is awesome, definitely. I'm enjoying that very much. So as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Functional Neurological Disorders, and otherwise known as Conversion Disorder. And there's a little bit of vocabulary cleanup that we're going to do when we get into the meat of the discussion, because some of my sources have said other things. But Dr. Mathis, who knows this topic, can straighten y'all out in a second. So we'll get to that in a moment. And before we do that, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so the last time we left our heroes talking about the Gretsch Masterbuilt shop. So tonight I thought I would talk about the Fender Masterbuilt shop, since technically speaking, the Gretsch Masterbuilt shop is housed inside the Fender plant because Fender bought Gretsch. So... But they have their own set of master builders, some of which are shared between the two and some of which are not. So tonight I'm going to be talking about the Fender master builders, and these are in no particular order. So I'm just going to be shouting out, giving you a quick bio of each person. So the first person I'm going to talk about is Chris Fleming, who is an original native Californian, which isn't true of all of our master builders, who started playing guitar around 8 years old and then started modifying instruments not too long afterwards. Worked originally at a repair shop in Long Beach, which kind of got him his credentials and practice doing instrument design and repair and restoration of older guitars. And then in the year 2000, joined the Fender Custom Shop and then was assigned, as a master builder assistant. So he's a, an apprentice, so to speak, to master builders like John English, Alan Hamill, and Fred Stewart. And since then, he's done a variety of apprenticeships with various master builders, but he's also been schlepped around as chief engineer and guitar guy for research and development and director of build standards, and finally moved back to the custom shop after being schlepped around. I guess that's what happens when you're good at a lot of things. So he's now back at the custom shop, which I understand he's very happy about. Okay, so Dale Wilson, if I could talk tonight, it'd be dangerous, started in the custom shop in 2005 and was awarded the title Master Builder in 2011. So he's a guy who also really just been into guitar and building and, since very, very, very early. I think right out of high school, he started working for a small guitar shop and eventually worked for the Dobro Company. Most people call resonator guitars Dobros, but that's kind of like calling tissues Kleenexes. It's really a brand name. So he started working for the Dobro Company, making resonators, and then Rickenbacker before ending up at Fender. While at Fender, he's worked on Gretsch guitars, Guild guitars, Benedetto guitars, and before he actually joined the custom shop master builder stuff. So he's done all kinds of interesting one-offs and signed several headstocks at the 2011 NAMM show, which is what got him his quote-unquote Master Bill status. And he's done a lot of really unusual guitars, like a Resophonic Thinline Telecaster, which is really cool if you haven't seen one of those. There's not a shit ton of them out there. So, yeah, you know, you have to be a nerd builder guy to know that kind of stuff, or a trivia nerd like myself. Paul Waller, who is a South California native, and been doing Lutheran woodworking for a really, really long time, joined his high school wood shop, I think, at 14, and then right out of high school started working at a wood shop outside of that, and did a stint at with a California guitar maker, and then eventually enrolled in the Roberto Venn School of Luthery in Phoenix, Arizona. And I think he graduated in 2000 and then joined Fender in 2003. And he's worked with archtop craftsmen, in particular Bob Benedetto, who is just world-renowned in his archtop guitar stuff. So he did that sort of apprenticeship under that. And then after 7 years of apprenticeship, became a master builder himself in 2010. And he has quite a pedigree of guitars and basses he's done. He's done a bass for Adam Clayton, who plays bass for U2, a thin line Telecaster for Bono, which is the U2 vocalist. Done Telecasters for Keith Richards, worked on Stratocasters for Ron Wood and for Buddy Guy and for Nile Rodgers. And at one point, did a double neck Jazzmaster guitar for Troy Van Leeuwen of Queens of the Stone Age. Steven Stern, who I mentioned last time we did the show, is a master builder for Gretsch, but he's also a Fender master builder, and started out working under archtop luthiers like Jimmy D'Acquisito and Bob Benedetto, and had worked previously at Charvel Jackson Guitars. And done all kinds of custom shop work with D'Acquisito in 1993 until he died in 1995. And since that time, in the late 1990s, there was this uber guitar collector that was evidently some kind of millionaire guy, Scott Shinnery, who had frankly never even heard of, who commissioned him to do a bunch of guitars for him, archtop type guitars. Which are actually called the Blue Guitar Collection, and I guess that's because most of them are blue. I haven't seen all of them. I've only seen a couple that are actually now in the Smithsonian. So Steven Stern's got like works of art in the Smithsonian. He also built a few guitars in collaboration with the Walt Disney Company to commemorate the Fantasia anniversary. So he's got some archtops of Fantasia characters on them, which is, I think, really cool. Okay, Jason Smith, who is actually the son of Dan Smith, who has been working for Fender forever as a research and development guy. So Jason Smith, it was sort of a natural progression for him to work for Fender. And despite the fact that he was born in Rochester, New York, he was raised in California. And because of his dad's position, he was going backstage to concerts and meeting people like Clapton and Yngwie Malmsteen and Jeff Beck and Robin Ford. And so, you know, he's met Geddy Lee from Rush and David Gilmour for Pink Floyd and, you know, ZZ Top guys and the whole nine yards. So he's been way a long time affiliated with rock music and the Fender Custom Shop, which he joined officially in 95. And then in 2006 completed an apprenticeship under John English, who was a senior master builder there. And he's marked together with John English on a bunch of projects, including a double neck Stratocaster for Dan DeLeo, who is a Stone Temple Pilots guitar player, but he's also worked on guitars for Michael Landau, for Flea, for Geddy Lee, for Steve Harris of Iron Maiden, to Linkin Park, to Kenny Wayne Shepherd, and the John 5 Telecaster, one of which I own, which is a real piece of instrumental gear. It's the weirdest looking Telecaster you've ever seen. Plays and sounds fabulous, but it... It's in the vernacular of the South, that Telecaster rang right. It's funky. Okay, so we're going to move on to Yuri Shishkov, who is obviously of Russian descent. And he, I really, Yuri's stuff that he does is unflippin' believable. It's playable art. I've seen several of his works, and it's just like holy moly crazy stuff. Yeah, he's originally from, and I'm probably going to mispronounce that, Gomel in the Soviet Union, now back to Russia. But he first started building guitars just for friends and buddies and came to the United States in 1990, settling in Chicago, and collaborated at that point with a lot of top artists, including Dimebag Darrell, Jimmy Page. Oh, yeah. Nuno Bettencourt of Extreme, Robin Zander of Cheap Trick, and Paul Stanley of Kiss. I joined the custom shop in 2000, and if you've ever seen any of his master bills, they are unflipping believable. I mean, it's just, his work reminds me a lot of Taya, who I've mentioned as a master builder. It has an independent luthiership, and his stuff is just playable art. But I mean, you know, he was mentored under Zemaitis, who is like one of the uber first guitarist playable art guys, who made guitars for, you know, Ron Wood when he was with the Faces, and George Harrison, and all the classic guys back in the day. Mm-hmm. So moving on to Todd Kraus, who has built guitars for people like Eric Clapton, David Gilmour, Robbie Robertson, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Jeff Beck, Robin Trower, Roger Waters, and Eric Clapton. So like some of his other fellow luthiers, he started out with the Jackson Charvel Company and came to Fender in 1991 and started doing one-off instrument builds. Also is involved in research and development. Became a custom shop master builder in 97. And the stuff he does is also really interesting. His motto is form and function, and he talks about it being the biggest part of what he does, so that the instrument sounds good and feels good, but it, quote-unquote, has to look cool and compel you to play. That's a direct quote from Todd. Okay, so then we walk into another really classy master builder, Dennis Galuzka, who is, I don't know where his heritage heralds from, but he is originally from Southern California and has been doing high-end acoustic guitars as a cabinet maker, which is what he started out as. He's also a drummer, which is real interesting, and started doing the job interview that led to a steady gig with the Fender Custom Shop, I think, in 1999. And after working there for only 8 months, he was promoted to master builder. So he obviously had a few building skills prior to arriving to Fender. And like some of his other predecessors, has built guitars for folks like Johnny Marr, who most people probably don't know unless you're a punk rocker, who's very, very influential in that. Andy Summers from The Police, Paul McCartney, Patrick Stump of Fall Out Boy, and Mike Dirnt of Green Day. So he's done a shoot ton of guitars and basses for folks. And Glusga's thing is all about the feel and sound of the instrument. And in his own words, those things are number one with me above everything else. Dennis Fesler came to the custom shop in 1990, and he has also done cooperative guitars with people like Robin Ford, Neil Schon of Journey, Jeff Healey when he was alive, Hank Martin, who is a quintessential guy in the 50s, Joe Bonamassa, Pete Wentz, you know, again, the list goes on. This guy is master builder for Fender, who just does these really solid, creative pieces of gear that just, as one of the biographers of him cited him as saying, the perfect example of the intense commitment it takes to earn the title. That's probably true. Hey, give it up, let's see I with this kind of stuff. That would not be me. Ron Thorne does a lot of inlay work at the custom shop, so he's kind of famous for that. He does a shoot ton of doing he is actually the sole inlay guy at Fender and has been at the custom shop since the mid-90s, has done more than 800 custom instruments under his own name of Thorne Guitars, and now works exclusively for the Fender custom shop, and is one of the first people to be given the title of principal master builder, which is basically the highest level of the food chain you can get in the luthier business. Kyle McMillan was an employee for 15 years and just finished an apprenticeship recently under Yuri Shishkov. Oh, there we go, that name again, who worked with him on over 1,000 guitars. So, you know, he has a good pedigree. Carlos Lopez, which started with him playing guitar as a teenager. And as I like to jokingly paraphrase the famous song, he was born in East L.A. Oh, God. That, I actually stole that from Cheech and Chong. So he graduated from the Musicians Institute of Guitar Craft in 2006 and started working for Fender Custom Shop in 2007 and was part of a team-built division until he earned his master builder credentials, became an apprentice master builder under Todd Krause. So you can see how these guys like work under each other, which I think is really, really cool, in 2017, and has worked with Todd on some of the guitars for Robin Trower, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, right? So obviously we've had a little experience, and he's done a lot of really interesting stuff. Most of the stuff that Lopez does, a lot of it has to do with relicking kinds of stuff, which I personally despise. But I'm not slamming the guy because he does fabulous work. It's just relics are not my cup of tea. But they are a bunch of people's cup of tea. And the one thing, the one that he's probably most familiar with is he did this kind of ice blue metallic Telecaster that he reliced, the 69 Telecaster that he did in this ice, in this aged ice blue metallic. So it has kind of a greenish kind of hue to it. And did that with master builder Scott Buell. He also did an acrylic, transparent acrylic Stratocaster for Gabriella, right, Wilson, the artist better known as Her, and which she had at the 2019 Grammy Awards. So he has definitely done some major dillies himself. And finally, Vincent van Tricht, which I'm probably mispronouncing because he's one of those Netherlands guys whose names I always have trouble with, who came to California, I think, in 2005 and started working for Fender pretty much from the get-go in a variety of different departments before he landed in the custom shop in 2012. Did a two-year assistant role with Stephen Stern, probably one of my all-time favorite master builders. I have two of Stephen Stern's master builds there from the Gretsch shop. They're just freaking fabulous. And then did a five-year apprenticeship with John Cruise. So he obviously has a really good pedigree himself. He's worked with many previous kind of cool limited run and short run pieces, including a 61 Stratocaster, a replica of Gary Moore's 61 Stratocaster, and did a very limited run of Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan's 30th anniversary Stratocaster guitars, and I think there was only 30 pieces of those made worldwide. And recently did the custom shop version of the Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy fame of his Precision bass. So, again, all of these guys have produced some really, really cool gear. And whether it's your cup of tea gear or not, their pedigrees are unmistakable. And some of the folks they've built for are unmistakable. And some of the folks they've apprenticed under are unmistakable. So you can't knock any of these folks who have really spent probably a lifetime, in some cases for sure a lifetime, trying to hone their art, and I just feel really lucky that I own several pieces from them. So woohoo for me and double woohoo for them.
That's pretty cool. So let me ask you this. If we were doing Fenders tonight, are there more pictures of babies you want me to put up?
I don't have a Master Bill Fender, but that's not true. I have a Master Bill Telly that I can send you a picture of that. It's gorgeous. It's Pelham Blue. It's just, it's the bomb. It's a very unusual Telecaster with a it's got a Chet Atkins whammy on it. So it's Chet, when Chet was getting his whammies from because Chet played Gretches predominantly, and he didn't like the straight arm that all the Bigsby's have, so he wanted him to do this kind of crooked, kind of funky whammy arm. And so he had them put the Chet Atkins whammy bar on the Bigsby on this Fender Telly, and it's a Fender Telecaster, but it's got a Stratocaster neck on it. So it's like, what?
Ooh,
yeah, it's cool. It's cool. It's cool. And actually, the only other one I've ever seen of those was when I saw the video of Clapton when he was playing with Blind Faith when they did their opening show at Hyde Park. And he had this disgusting-looking sunburst. I hate sunbursts. Most of the listeners probably know sunbursts is my most absolutely hated finish on any guitar, even though it's everybody's favorite finish. I absolutely despise it. Be that as it may, I'm sure Clapton could give two shits about what I like and don't like. But yeah, and he's good enough not to care. He had this sunburst Telecaster with a Stratocaster neck on it. And I was like, what the heck is that? And it was just the most bizarro thing. And I'm like, I've never seen that. And I wonder how that plays. Because obviously I've never seen one because he's never made one. Because that was something he had the Fender Custom Shop do for him. And that was kind of right during the era he was doing those and doing the 335s. And then eventually went to Stratocasters. And that's been his primary guitar ever since. Since he's, as I like to jokingly refer to him, a trader from Gibson. Anyway, oops, I didn't say that. so that was the only other Telecaster I've ever seen with a Stratocaster neck on it, but mine's got it. And it's way cool, and it does play well, and I see why he did it, and that's because he's a lot smarter than I am, but we all knew that anyway. It's a really cool, but it's one of my favorite colors, which is Pelham Blue, and it's not relic, thank you very much. And it's just way, way cool. And it's got a kind of a bypass switch on it, toggle. So if you hit the bypass switch, it bypasses all the controls, and it just gives you this volume boost. And just it's a rocking piece of gear. And it's got Jazzmaster pickups on it. So it's kind of this sort of Tele, sort of Jazzmaster, sort of Stratocaster guitar. So it's cool. I'll send you pictures. Yeah.
Okay, fabulous. All righty. Well, thank you for all that. Oh, my goodness. Okay. So we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All righty, so it is time to get to the meat and potatoes. As I mentioned earlier, I entitled the episode Functional Neurological Disorders. I'm going to give a brief explanation to you guys, and then before we get started, I'm going to turn to Dr. Mathis to do a little bit of terminology cleanup here because some of the sources do not concur with how he wants to interpret it, so we're going to give him a chance to explain to you guys how he sees it. So from my notes, functional neurological disorder, or FND sometimes, is a medical condition in which there are problems with the functioning of the nervous system and how the brain and body sends and receives signals, rather than a structural disease process such as MS or having a stroke. FND can encompass a wide variety of neurological symptoms such as limb weakness or seizures. FND is a condition at the interface between the specialties of neurology and psychiatry. It's not well known to modern U.S. culture as many other medical conditions, and is still being evaluated and explained today. So tonight we will talk about the history of FND. FND as we know it today, controversies and misconceptions, but I'm going to do the terminology now and not in section three, and then resources for support. So I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and if you would like to do some explaining and interpretation for our listeners, this would be a good time to do that.
Okay, and you've got mail. So I just sent you pictures of the aforementioned Telecaster. So.
Oh, so I can drool while you're talking. Perfect.
or laugh, depending on your mood. Okay, so functional neurological symptom disorder is sometimes referred to as that and sometimes referred to as conversion disorder. So you can call it either one at this stage. I suspect that when the new DSM comes out, it'll all be functional neurological symptom disorder. So that falls under, in the DSM-5, that falls under somatic symptom and related disorders category. So what that really is a fancy term for is it's bodily dysfunctions that happen because of emotional dysregulation, which is a fancy way of saying if you're too stressed out, too depressed, too histrionic, too fill-in-the-blank, and you do it for a long period of time, your brain starts to produce a bunch of chemistry that dysregulates your body. And for some people, it hits the organ system. For some people, it hits the nervous system. For some people, it hits their muscles. And for some people, it's all over the place, the GI system. So you can have people that have these miscellaneous aches and pains. They could be vomiting. They could have constipation. They could, you know, have partial paralysis or numbness or tingling or all kinds of, you know, stuff. And their real body problems, their real somatic or body problems, it's not somebody making it up. It's not somebody BSing about it. And it's not somebody being hypochondriacal, right? It is somebody with real functional problems. But the problems are caused because they didn't take care of their emotional stuff, and now their emotional stuff has overwhelmed their body's chemistry, and their body's basically bitch-smacking them. And so they wouldn't take care of their emotional problems, and now their emotional problems are they're convoiting to physical issues, and that's why it's got the term conversion disorder. So you'll often see that with people with histrionic personality disorder, with borderline personality disorder, with chronic anxiety disorder, very, 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 very common. If they have PTSD and they haven't taken care of the PTSD and it's got a huge, like, over-startle response reaction kind of thing, it'll happen with that too. Right. And so under all of these, right, the conversion disorder / functional neurological symptom disorder is just one of about eight different disorders under the somatic symptom related disorders. And I don't want to get into all of those because, you know, you have usual garbage can one, and then you have usual one that's the garbage can. We're going to tell you kind of what it looks like, and one we're not going to tell you what it looks like. But
yeah.
Basically the big, it's like, nah, 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 right? I don't know why anybody would do that. But the big one is the conversion disorder one. And then you specify what type of symptomatology under the conversion disorder / functional neurological symptom disorder you have. So do you have weakness or paralysis? And each one of these gets a different code. So the general code is F44 point something. And then if you have the weakness or paralysis, that's 44.4. Right. In fact, several of these have the same number, so you have to say which one they are. And I don't know why they do that either. They did that with the previous DSMs too, and I was like, really? With abnormal movement, so you could have like a funky gait. With swallowing symptoms, so your throat kind of closes up and you have trouble swallowing. And all of those are F44.4. And speech problems, so you can't get stuff out. You choke on your words. And that's not a verbal expression issue. That's like a physical, your throat closes up kind of thing. All of those are 44.4. And then you have 44.5 as you have seizures and or like attacks. So you can go into like seizure-like stuff. 44.6 is anesthesia or sensory loss. So you have basically what people would used to call hysterical blindness or hysterical deafness. That's a conversion disorder. And I actually had one of those about 15 years ago. Very, very strange. was somebody who had histrionic personality disorder, so it wasn't a surprise how they got it, but it was just, I'd never seen it live, and I was like, whoa. 44.6 also is with any kind of sensory symptom issues. 44.7 is you got a mix of some or all of the aforementioned ones, and then you have to specify whether it's an acute episode or a persistent episode, and do you also have psychological stressors? Well, that's a duh. And then you have to specify what the stressor is, like recent loss of a spouse or pet or job or whatever, and then or without psychological stressors. And I can tell you I have never seen one of these without psychological stressors, because what usually happens is the person has had this, been doing the conversion stuff for a long time, but they've been doing sort of kind of wimpy stuff, and they'll typically go to doctors, and they'll go to a shoot ton of doctors. Then all the doctors will say, oh, it's all in your head, which technically they're true. But what the doctors are implying is they're making it up and they're delusional, and that's not true. And so they'll doctor shop, and sometimes they'll go to some physician who will just give them something to shut them up, basically, as opposed to referring them to somebody like me to get assessed and go, oh, wait a minute, right? As, or they'll give them a pill for what ails them, so to speak, and that's not going to solve the problem, because the problem is mental. It's not physiological, even though it's presenting as a physiological problem. Mm-hmm. So that's the story.
Got it. Okay. So listeners, please bear that in mind, because that may affect how you perceive some of the other stuff I'm going to read to you tonight. Just assume that they're interchangeable for now, and also understand that, you know, in the next big revision of the DSM, a lot of this is going to end up getting wiggled anyway. So hopefully that will help you following the time. Yeah, yep. At least hopefully they won't do what they did to Asperger's.
Yeah, sort of formally known as.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But
Asperger's, did I say that?
Yes. And, well, that's fair. I didn't bring this up in the script, but there was a lot of talk about some of the, I've forgotten the term for it, well, you know, we, other disorders that are parallel with something, and you named mm-hmm. several that were in the notes, but we were starting to get a little pedantic, so I didn't get into that.
Yeah, consider the source, right? If it's me, I'm going to get pedantic.
It's me too. Me too. But no need for both of us to do it. And I knew that you wanted to explain the vocabulary thing so that we're all on the same page. All right.
Cool.
So with that, let's go ahead and dive in. I've got the history of functional neurological disorders, and that'll probably help you all understand how the terminology got wiggled in the first place, because it gets into that at the end. Source for this is largely a paper called Hysteria to Functional Neurological Disorders, A Historical Perspective by Maureen Cassidy, MD. This was published online September 2019 in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And Maureen says, unexplained symptoms in functional neurologic and somatoform disorders have mystified physicians for centuries. The understanding of such phenomena evolved in parallel with advances in medicine, neuroanatomy, and societal views of gender, and also have a role in the development of psychoanalysis. As theories progressed, so did the descriptive terminology, from hysteria to Babinski's pathetism, and from Freud's conversion neurosis to DSM-5's, quote, functional neurological symptom disorder, which Dr. Mathis mentioned earlier. The word hysteria originated in Greek writings as hysterikos, describing symptoms from a wandering uterus. I know you guys have heard us mention this before. It's amusing now, but kind of disturbing. This association framed the idea that hysteria was a disease afflicting women. The term hysteria persisted in the Middle Ages, often explained by witchcraft or the supernatural. Theories moved away from a uterine cause, notably with the influences of English physician Thomas Willis and French physician Pierre Briquet. A variety of psychological and medical symptoms were encompassed in the syndrome of hysteria, and it was increasingly recognized in men, although more often diagnosed as hypochondriasis, I'm butchering that, I'm so sorry, and generally attributed to medical causes. In the 19th century, general interest in hysteria was renewed through the influence of French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot from the Salpêtrière School of Neurology in Paris. I'm not even going to begin to try to pronounce this or spell it for you guys. theatrical, there are a lot of accents, and I'm not going to sit here and describe them all. This crazy French. At least you're not going to call it the Saltpeter School. Anyway, these theatrical public demonstrations using hypnotism to reproduce symptoms in patients were criticized for the influence of suggestion, and I think that's fair. Charcot initially defined hysteria as symptoms such as an organic brain lesion without discoverable anatomic pathology, and postulated that these inconsistent symptoms could be due to dynamic lesions. Later in his career, he noted psychological aspects of hysteria and wrote about the correlation between past trauma and symptomatology. So there's a brick in the wall there heading towards the path. After Charcot's death in 1893, his students expanded on his work, notably French neurologist Joseph Babinski, who we mentioned earlier, who proposed the term pithiatism. Although short-lived, the term describes symptoms brought on by suggestion and cured with persuasion. Babinski's legacy was in differentiating symptoms of hysteria from those of organic disease, as described in the 1917 book, Hysteria-Pithiatism and Reflex, Nervous Disorders in the Neurology of War, written in response to increasing symptom presentations during World War I. So there you have your trauma factor coming in. He famously distinguished between, yes, hysterical and organic hemiplegia.
That's
by
correct.
Using thank you. I struggle with these sometimes. They catch me by surprise. By using neurologic signs, including toe extension, contractures, and tongue deviation. Austrian neurologist Sigmund Freud studied under Charcot from 1885 to 86, marking his career transition from neuroanatomy to the study of hysteria and to psychoanalysis. He initially focused on differentiating organicity from hysteria on the basis of neuroanatomy. In a series of patient interviews, he found a correlation between hysteria and childhood sexual abuse, later noting that he may have, quote, overestimated the frequency of such events, you think? End quote. Freud hypothesized that the reports of abuse were indeed the patient's own sexual fantasies. This was the start of his foundation of psychoanalysis. The hysteria of prior generations encompassed symptoms that today would be categorized among a variety of diagnoses, including dissociation, anxiety, trauma-related disorders, and personality disorders. Freud used the term conversion neurosis to describe the unconscious during a physical manifestation, and this term progressed into conversion disorder. DSM-5 introduced the additional term functional neurological symptom disorder and removed the need for known psychological conflict from the diagnosis criteria, bridging a diagnostic gap between the fields of neurology and psychiatry. With current research in neuroimaging, neural networks, and treatment, including repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, the understanding of functional neurological disorder continues to evolve. And here I'm going to pause and check in with Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything he would like to add.
Nope, I'm good.
All righty, let's get going to the next part. I have to admit a quick giggle when they were talking about neural networks, because for me that's an artificial intelligence term, and I wasn't sure if that was what they meant or not.
Stuff comes from the brain stuff, so.
Yes. I worked in an AI lab for a couple of years for the director, and I learned quite a bit of those things, but, you know, I definitely am on the layperson side of the table. I've got one foot in one world and one foot in the other. That was a lot of fun, but I digress. Okay, next part, functional neurological disorders today. And also, you know, you can assume this is conversion that I'm talking about. Historically, FND has been traditionally viewed as an entirely psychological disorder in which repressed psychological stress or trauma gets converted into a physical symptom. This is where the term conversion disorder comes from. Psychological disorders and stressful life events, both recent and in childhood, may be risk factors for developing the condition in some patients, but they rarely provide a full explanation for the cause of the condition and are absent in many patients. Patients do not have to be depressed, anxious, or the survivor of adverse childhood experience to develop FND. Out of curiosity, Dr. Mathis, do they understand why people develop it when they don't have these in their background?
In my opinion, that's utter horse manure. I have never seen a conversion disorder that didn't have either depression, anxiety, PTSD, or a cluster B personality disorder.
Gotcha.
Never. I think they're full of shit, frankly. But they did not list personality disorders. I would agree that you don't have to have adverse child experiences because you can have the trauma in adulthood, or you can have enough, right? And the other thing I would say is not everybody with trauma or depression or anxiety or cluster B develops conversion disorder, because you have to take into account other factors such as resiliency, social support, dietary intake, physical condition, do the exercise and do things that sort of help counteract and delay some of the stuff. So it's certainly, what I would agree with is there's not a one-to-one correlation between the two, and that's absolutely true. The vast majority of people who have depression or anxiety or PTSD, particularly depression and anxiety, don't necessarily develop conversion symptoms. It's those folks who have them over long periods of time and then keep compounding them with other things that develop that, and their systems and or their systems are more sensitive than others. They come with a more biologically sensitive system or less resilient system, and those are the folks that develop it. It is definitely not a one-to-one correlation. That's absolutely true.
Got it. Well, you know, if it helps, my next source in line does actually mention the personality disorder, so let's go ahead and get to that part.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so this next chunk is from MedlinePlus.gov. At the U.S. National Library of Medicine, and this is their take on it. Conversion disorder symptoms may occur because of a psychological conflict. Symptoms usually begin suddenly after a stressful experience. People are at risk for conversion disorder if they also have, one, a medical illness, and you don't have to have all of these, but you could have any of these. Two, a dissociative disorder, escape from reality that is not on purpose. Three, a personality disorder, inability to manage feelings and behaviors that are expected in certain social situations. People who have conversion disorder are not making up their symptoms in order to obtain shelter, for example, malingering. They are also not intentionally injuring themselves or lying about their symptoms just to become a patient, which is factitious disorder. Some healthcare providers falsely believe that conversion disorder is not a real condition and may tell people that the problem is all in their head. But the condition is real. Yeah, you know, we're laughing, but sadly that happens to people.
Oh, I know.
It causes distress and cannot be turned on and off at will. And that's part of the reason we do these shows, is so that people will know, even if your particular doctor is not well-versed in this, you're not imagining it and just keep going until you find somebody who believes you, because they should.
Yeah, all right. Absolutely.
The physical symptoms are thought to be an attempt to resolve the conflict the person feels inside. For example, a woman who believes it's not acceptable to have violent feelings may suddenly feel numbness in her arms after becoming so angry that she wanted to hit someone. Instead of allowing herself to have violent thoughts about hitting someone, she experiences a physical symptom of numbness in her arms. All right, this next take on it is from the Mayo Clinic. Functional neurologic disorders, a newer and broader term that includes what some people call conversion disorder, and this is where we have the terminology, thing that we need to reconcile. But you guys stay with me, and bear in mind Dr. Mathis's explanation when I say this, featured nervous system, neurological symptoms that can't be explained by a neurological disease or other medical condition. However, the symptoms are real and cause significant distress or problems functioning. Signs and symptoms vary depending on the type of functional neurological disorder and may include neurologic, I keep saying neurological, I apologize, may include specific patterns. Typically, these disorders affect your movement or your senses, such as the ability to walk, swallow, see, or hear, you know, hence the Tommy thing at the beginning. Symptoms can vary in severity and may come and go or be persistent. However, you can't intentionally produce or control your symptoms. The cause of functional neurologic disorders is unknown. The condition may be triggered by a neurological disorder or by a reaction to stress or psychological or physical trauma, but that's not always the case. Functional neurologic disorders are related to how the brain functions rather than damage to the brain structure, such as from a stroke, MS, infection, or injury. Early diagnosis and treatment, especially education about the condition, can help with recovery. Symptoms. Symptoms of functional neurologic disorders may vary depending on the type of functional neurological disorder, and they're significant enough to cause impairment and warrant medical evaluation. Symptoms can affect body movement and function and the senses. Signs and symptoms that affect body movement and function may include weakness or paralysis, abnormal movement such as tremors or difficulty walking, loss of balance, difficulty swallowing or feeling a lump in the throat, seizures or episodes of shaking and apparent loss of consciousness, non-epileptic seizures, or episodes of unresponsiveness. Signs and symptoms that affect the senses may include numbness or loss of the touch sensation, speech problems such as inability to speak or slurred speech, vision problems such as double vision or blindness, and hearing problems or deafness. When to see a doctor. Seek medical attention for signs and symptoms listed above. Pretty much anything on the list there you should talk to your doctor about. If the underlying cause is a neurological disease or another medical condition, quick diagnosis and treatment may be important. If the diagnosis is a functional neurologic disorder, treatment may improve the symptoms and help prevent future problems. Causes. The exact cause of functional neurologic disorders is unknown. Theories regarding what happened to the brain to result in symptoms are complex and involve multiple mechanisms that may differ depending on the type of functional neurologic disorder. Basically, parts of the brain that control the functioning of your muscles and senses may be involved, even though no disease or abnormality exists. Symptoms of functional neurologic disorders may appear suddenly after a stressful event or with emotional or physical trauma. Other triggers may include changes or disruptions in how the brain functions at the structural, cellular, or metabolic level, but the trigger for symptoms can't always be identified. Risk factors. Factors that may increase your risk of functional neurologic disorders include having a family member with functional neurologic disorder, having a mental health condition such as a mood or anxiety disorder, dissociative disorder, or certain personality disorders, having a neurological disease or disorder such as epilepsy, migraines, or a movement disorder, possibly having a history of physical or sexual abuse or neglect in childhood, and this is, as you heard earlier, debated, recent significant stress or emotional or physical trauma, and it also says women may be more likely than men to develop functional neurologic disorders. Complications. Some symptoms of functional neurologic disorders, particularly if not treated, can result in substantial disability and poor quality of life similar to that caused by medical conditions or disease. And here I'm going to pause and check in with Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything else that he would like to add.
I can tell you that in terms of the gender ratio, while I've seen a few more women than men that have it, It's not been crazy. I mean, it's like 60-40. It's not like crazy differentials, gender differentials that I've seen between the two genders that have this that I've seen with it.
So the difference is really slight.
Yeah, at least in my population. But, you know, keep in mind, I see predominantly adolescents, young adults, and families. So a lot of the cases I have involve ADHD, and most ADHD people have histrionic tendencies, and those with a shoot ton of histrionic tendencies tend to develop conversion symptoms, even if they don't fall fully into the category of being diagnosed with a conversion disorder. They certainly have conversion-like symptoms without question. And as most of our audience probably knows, ADHD is overrepresented in the male population. Big time overrepresented. So that might be part of the reason why I've seen a pretty equal balance between the two genders. And then the females that I've seen that have had it have either had ADHD, borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, or some anxiety type disorder like PTSD or chronic generalized anxiety or social phobia or something of that nature. And they come in all ages. So I've seen, you know, folks as young as 14 or 15 with it. I've seen people in their 50s with it. So it's not, oh, they're just immature and they're overreacting teenagers. No, this is way above and beyond the normal drama stuff that you see kids doing. That's way above and beyond. And I have a lot of parents that will say, oh, well, you know, I see that my son or daughter has, you know, scored really high on the MNPI on some of these things. But, you know, they're a teenager, and I'm like, this is normed against their gender and peer-normed group. So your son or daughter is, like, uber different from his or her own age and gender cohort. We're not talking comparing this person against, you know, old farts like myself. We're talking about people in this guy or gal's age group and gender group. And the parents look at me like, oh, and I'm thinking, come on, that's like common sense. Really? Why would I, you know, it's like comparing an apple to an, well, I'm sorry, sir, your apple has redder skin than your orange. It should have orange skin. What? I mean, come on. But I get that a lot. So I don't really see a big, I don't really see that big of a more likely discrepancy between men and women. I really don't. I mean, maybe 60-40, but it's pretty close. It's definitely not like ADHD where out of the God knows how many thousands, and I'm not joking, because I used to work in the prisons and I used to work in hospitals too, of cases that I've tested, you know, where I've seen my most recent person I saw was like my 99th woman that I've tested out of like, you know, 7,000 that had ADHD. So it's a way overrepresented in the male population kind of disorder. That's not the case with the conversion disorder, at least my experience. Now, I don't know what the national norms are because, you know, I just don't look at that stuff. And frankly, I don't give a flip because I'm concerned about what things impact my patient population.
Gotcha. Okay, fair enough. All right. So let's go to the next section, controversies and misconceptions. And this one is somewhat short. The main controversies and misconceptions surrounding FND are discussed in other segments of tonight's show already, these primarily being the condition being dismissed as being faked for attention or other gains. While such things have happened, we hope tonight to educate our listeners how to differentiate between that and someone in genuine need of medical help. So how to help a loved one with conversion disorder. If you have a loved one experiencing conversion disorder symptoms, it's important to believe them and not accuse them of faking their symptoms. These symptoms are very real, even if their origin is not totally understood. Be aware that initially, your loved one may experience frustration and emotional distress when they are told by a neurologist or other professional that their symptoms are not linked to a specific neurological disease or other medical condition. Reassure them that you understand that their symptoms are real and that you're committed to helping them find the right professionals who can evaluate and treat their condition. If you think you might have conversion disorder, talk to your primary care provider. Make a list of your symptoms, any personal history that might be relevant, and that would, you know, bear in mind the stuff we were talking about earlier, and questions that you have for your doctor. Ask them whether they think a referral to a neurologist is the right next step and whether they recommend any other specialists for a diagnosis. And with this, they probably mean mental health professionals. It's your right to be informed about the latest research and treatment information for your condition, so don't hesitate to talk to your neurologist or other specialists for educational information that can help you make informed decisions about your care. Honestly, that's true of anything, but make sure you guys know that this is true. You can also ask them if they provide any referrals to psychiatrists and mental health professionals who specialize in treating conversion disorder and or any of your co-occurring diagnoses. Because conversion disorder is a lesser known condition, it's important to be patient while you're a patient when working with healthcare professionals. It might take a couple of appointments and conversations to find the right team of people who are dedicated to helping you manage your symptoms. Don't hesitate to get started today with building the support you need for treating conversion disorder and living your best life. Anything you want to add in here, Dr. Mathis?
I would just say when you're going for initial consultation, try to find somebody, you know, ask on the phone before you show up. You know, are they familiar with conversion disorder, or what's their experience of that sort of thing, conversion reaction, that kind of thing, and see what their staff person says. And if they say, oh, I don't know, let me ask the doctor, and they come back and go, oh, Dr. So-and-so doesn't really do that, or, oh, Dr. So-and-so, you know, is kind of lukewarm about it, call somebody else.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't even keep that appointment at that point. All righty. So last but not least, resources for support. And this talks about different therapies that are traditionally done with this. Okay. First, standard therapies. FND can be hard to understand, and most people haven't heard of it. Part of the reason we're doing this tonight. Treatment should start with a clear and supportive explanation of the positive clinical features that have allowed the diagnosis to be made, even though scans and other laboratory tests may be normal. When it goes well, understanding the diagnosis enables the patient to see that they have a genuine and relatively common condition which has the potential for improvement over time. This creates a foundation for treatment to build upon. Written information, such as that available at neurosymptoms.org or fndhope.org, may help individuals comprehend this complex and difficult to understand disorder. Evidence is now emerging for the efficacy of certain treatments, especially physiotherapy for motor symptoms, and a type of psychological therapy called, we've talked about this recently, cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, for attacks or seizures. Specialized types of physiotherapy and CBT have been developed for FND. So I guess you need to look for somebody who is specialized in that. Other therapies such as speech therapy and occupational therapy may also have a role depending on your symptoms. Physical therapy. For patients with motor symptoms such as limb weakness, gait problems, and GAIT, you know, you're walking, or movement disorder, physical therapy from a therapist who understands something of FND can be helpful. Physiotherapy approaches are active treatments that focus on retraining movement patterns that have gone wrong. There's some evidence from clinical trials that physiotherapy designed specifically for FND can be helpful for some patients. In recent years, we've learned that physical therapy for FND is different from that used for stroke or MS in many ways. For example, patients with stroke benefit from being asked to focus on the affected body part, whereas in FND, that tends to make things worse. Physical therapy for FND promotes automatic movements and reduces the abnormal brain patterns that have been interfering with movement. Psychological therapies. CBT is generally the first line of treatment for patients with dissociative non-epileptic seizures or attacks as part of their FND and is supported by clinical trials. Therapy includes time to learn more about their attacks and recognizing brief warning symptoms and learning techniques to regain control. For some patients, it is helpful to look more widely at thoughts, emotions, and experiences that could have played a role in the development of symptoms. For those patients without anxiety and depression, psychological therapy may still be useful in regaining confidence. FND itself is often experienced as a stressful condition to manage and live with. Other types of psychological therapies can also be used depending on the individual patient. For example, psychodynamic interpersonal therapy, or PIT, or more trauma-focused work for patients who have had such experiences. Occupational therapy. Occupational therapy assists patients in finding adaptations and regaining confidence in their ability to carry out daily activities in the home or workplace. Occupational therapy can help build on other therapies and to contribute to a better overall quality of life. Speech therapy. For patients with speech symptoms as part of their FND, speech therapy is an important part of treatment. Like physical therapy, the approach is different from that used, for example, after a stroke, and patients benefit from seeing therapists confident in this area. In other words, look for somebody who has this specialty and not just general experience. Other therapies. There is no research-based evidence from any specific medication is beneficial for FND, but medications may be useful for other symptoms commonly occurring with FND, such as pain, migraine, or anxiety. Other therapies are being investigated in research studies. Not everyone with FND can benefit from treatment, even if they do understand their condition and are well motivated. So just bear that in mind. And I'm going to check in with you at this point, Dr. Mathis.
I'm good, thanks.
All righty. So that is all we have. In summary, we hope now that our listeners better understand functional neurological disorders or conversion disorder. We anticipate that as modern medicine continues to study this condition, we'll better understand its causes and be able to help those who have it. So this concludes our show on functional neurological disorders / conversion disorder. Is there anything else that you want to talk about from any point in this evening, or are we good?
All I would say is don't let it, you know, don't let it get away from you. If you start feeling like you got it, go to somebody who knows what they're doing. And worst case scenario, they'll tell you that you don't have it and you can rest assured and not be stressed out about maybe having it, which is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. All righty. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, April 14th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Travel Itch Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Northern California, one of the prettiest places on the planet, takes center stage on Travel Itch Radio when Heather Knoll of Chalkboard Communications occupies the guest chair. Learn about the Skunk Train, Brewery Gulch Inn, Little River Inn, Mendocino, as she talks. Oh, that may be one place. I'm not really sure if that's one place or four different places because I'm not from California. But you guys can find out tomorrow when she talks with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Lee. Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. Sunday the 4th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, The Walking Dead Online Viewing Party is back with the 6 mini-episodes at the end of Season 10. So join us Sunday night for Season 10, Episode 22, Here's Negan on AMC. And join us online or on the air for real-time discussion, updates, trivia profiles, and more. And that will be followed on the 11th by Fear the Walking Dead, Season 6, Episode 8. Monday, 10 p.m., Monday Night in America, Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. This show may alternate on some Monday nights with our new show, The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega, in the same time slot. And Tuesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the diabolical dialogue of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they discuss another night of TV. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and rock on.